Six Nation Rugby is going on. We just played it.
Okay. Who's we?
The Senate Judiciary Committee will come to order. Today we are doing an informational hearing on databases, in particular getting an overview about criminal databases and criminal records. And we have invited the House Public Safety Policy Committee, which is chaired by Representative Deb Hillstrom, as well as the Crime Victims and Criminal Records Division, chaired by Representative John Lesch, to join us in this hearing. I think that the delay in our beginning of the meeting may be causing some members to be going in and out, so we will have members coming into the hearing. But we do have a House member with us today, and we want to welcome Representative Gail Kulik-Jackson for joining us. Thank you for being here. And to the members of the public who've been waiting, I apologize, but that's the nature of the work that we do, and I want to thank you for your patience and for your willingness to accommodate our schedule. Members, before we begin, I'd like to introduce you to two new members of the committee, or staff members of the committee. This year we have a new committee clerk. His name is Peter Mueller-Liley. Peter is back there. Coming from a two-syllable name, that was quite a challenge. And then we also have a committee intern who will be with us for the session also, and her name is Punapan Pumtalikith. Now, that, again, is the challenge coming from someone with a two-syllable name, but we want to welcome both of our new staff people to the committee, and feel free to talk to them if you need anything or need to get information to us. First on the agenda today, we're going to have Ms. Lori Beyer-Krupinski, the Director of the Information Policy Analysis Division, or IPAD, come and talk to us a little bit about the Minnesota Data Practices Act and just sort of some bigger, broader overview with respect to Minnesota data practices. So welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. As the Senator mentioned, I'm Lori Beyer-Krupinski. I am very excited to have this opportunity to speak to you. And I want to set the record first straight. Is before their Apple had iPod and iPad, my office, Information Policy Analysis, was already known as that. So we just want to lay claim to the name first. But as Senator Moore mentioned, I'm going to give you an overview of the Data Practices Act and then give you some more details on how data practices impacts law enforcement data. And since there are some super experienced people here, they're going to feel free to jump in if I forget anything or if they want to delve further into something. And then also, as you have questions, feel free to stop me as well. We provide data practices and open meeting law assistance to more than 12,000 people a year. We help the commissioner with her statutory duties, and you have a handout that details what the commissioner's duties are. Our citizens are among our customers, as well as the media, state and local government, as well as anyone else who needs help, so including legislators. And the part that probably is the most interest of you to what we do is that we provide legislative assistance in drafting. And IPAD's role is kind of unique for an office and a state agency in that we will frequently testify about bills that kind of what the impact of the bill is, does it work within existing state and federal law to achieve the outcome that the author intends, are there any unintended consequences. But because we also help the commissioner with her issuing advisory opinions, we will often come with legislative proposals of our own that either impact just data that admin maintains or data that's maintained by admin as well as every state and local government entity in Minnesota. So, and then after you pass legislation, we hope that we are there then to help explain what you meant by it. So that's really the role. So it's a little bit different than you'll traditionally see from a state agency. And I will acknowledge that Minnesota often has data practices, has a pretty, Neumeister hates when I say this, an unpopular, a kind of negative reputation. Certainly it is a complex area of law, but there are also some really simple features that make it unique that I want you to be able to walk away with today. One of the most important things for you to remember, this is a nice part for you, is that data practices doesn't apply to the legislature. So you have your own rules of access, as do the judicial branch. So the Data Practices Act doesn't apply to you.
Okay.
It applies to government entities in Minnesota, so state agencies, school districts, cities, counties, watershed districts, those kinds of organizations.
I'm not sure about this.
And government data is everything that's in recorded format. So your paper files, tapes, if we still have those anymore, DVDs, CDs, emails. If I go to Ferns and write out a staff meeting agenda on a cocktail napkin, I've written it down, that's still government data because it's all about work. And one of the things besides our weather that makes us unique is Minnesota's presumption. And that presumption is all data, all of it, is public unless it's specifically classified and protected by state or federal law. There are some examples of whole areas where the legislature has decided they're going to reverse that presumption. And some of those areas are in the employee personnel data records area, educational data, school records, and then also in your human services welfare data, you'll see a whole reversal of the presumption. So the end result of that is that we wind up having a lot of public data in Minnesota. So when data is public, anyone can have it and do anything they want with it. You've also passed a law that says that the government can't ask someone why they want data and what they're going to do with it. So the result is that a lot of the policy debate that we've been hearing over the last several years is how comfortable or uncomfortable the public would be of having their name or contact information, like email, used for marketing and other commercial purposes. Since you've said that all data is public and people can do whatever they want, people using it to market and commercial is completely acceptable. People using it even for campaign contributions, also completely acceptable. So that's kind of what gets us to the situation we're in now. And if you've always wondered, and I'm sure Senator Betzel has wanted to know, when will there be an end of data bills? It's not going to happen, but that's your fault. The legislature has reserved to itself the right to classify and protect data. No one else can do it but you. So that's why people will continue to keep coming to the legislature. You have given the Commissioner of Administration the power to temporarily classify data, but even then, those temporary classifications still come back here, and you get to decide whether or not they're going to be permanent. There is a great deal of specialized terminology in data practices, which I think, okay, it's full-time employment for lawyers. I have no other rationale for the detailed language. But when we're talking about living human beings, there is one of your handouts, Legislator's Guide to Data Practices. On the bottom right-hand side, you will see three classifications of data. It is says Legislator's Guide to Data Practices, should have some colored boxes on it. It should be hopefully in all the members' packets. When we're talking about living human beings, we have three kinds of data. It can be public data, it can be private, or it can be confidential. And many people, those are the only terms that they're really familiar with. Public data, as I said, anyone can have it and use it for any reason. When it's private data about me, I can have access to it. So think my personnel file at admin. I can also give permission, consent for someone else to have it, and then the government can use it for what purposes they need to do the work that they have within the agency, and then the law details who outside can get it for what purposes. But then we also have confidential data. So confidential data is, even though it's about me, I can't see it. So if the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension had me in the gang pointer file, even though I'm in the database, I wouldn't get to see that data. But that data still can be used within the Bureau as they needed to do their work and can get shared outside of the Bureau as you have allowed. We also have data classifications that cover data that isn't about living human beings, so when we're talking about businesses, property, stuff. And if you look in that bottom left-hand corner, you'll see that there's going to be comparable classifications. There'll still be public data about stuff, but there will also be non-public data about stuff. So if it's about my business, I can still have access and I can still give permission to have it be shared. But if it's protected non-public data about my business, then even though it's about my business, I can't have it. So if I had a car washing business and it was under investigation by St. Paul PD, it would be confidential data. I wouldn't be able to see it. But, and also the data about my business would be protected non-public. So that's kind of how those terms work together. I know that's a lot of classifications about people and things, but when we want to talk about them generically, we just say data is not public, and that would include all those classifications. So if you need a shorthand, just use not public. And this is the part where we say, if I ran the world, what would the legislature do? Oh, Senator Ma, you didn't say that I could do that? Okay, if I ran the world, the legislature would, all of you in all of your bills, would remember the presumption that data is always public and that you don't need to have a laundry list of things that are public, because the commissioner has issued lots of advisory opinions that say that's just a partial restatement of the presumption. If you want to protect specific data elements, you know how to do that, and then everything else remains public so that you don't have to have huge lists of what's public. And when you decide what data to protect and who to share it with, I want you to remember this balancing chart that's up in this upper right-hand corner. Clearly, the government needs data to be able to do its work, so that's kind of the centerpiece. And sometimes folks can argue about how much data does government really need to do their work, and that's a fair debate to have. But then we're going to be balancing the public's right to know and accountability versus individual privacy rights. And sometimes in data practices terms, we treat businesses differently, and we afford more privacy rights to individual human beings than we do businesses. So we'll sometimes see differences in that. There are a number of federal laws that impact this area and sometimes trump state law. Some of the big ones, and they're listed in the middle of this chart, is HIPAA around medical records, FERPA, which is the Family Educational Rights Privacy Act, which is around educational and school records for students, and then the Driver's Privacy Protection Act. So those are really the biggest three federal laws that you'll see talked about, and whether or not what the Minnesota legislature wants to do is going to fit with that and really work with federal law. I don't know if anyone, you're wondering, why is data practices still just as important? Open government, and it is clearly government accountability will always be fundamental to a strong democracy. All of these state and federal privacy laws came about in the 70s. It was the era of J. Edgar Hoover and his secret files, Watergate, the Pentagon Papers. So Minnesota's law was established in 74 to protect us from secret files and secret arrests and secret databases, the existence of which people didn't even know the databases existed. And the need for these protections, one person's perspective, is just as important today as it was in 1974. So the three things for you to remember are the presumption is data is always public. If I say that five times, you'll all remember that. That the legislature decides what data should get protected and who it gets shared with. And that remember that three-legged stool about government need, individual privacy, and the public's right to know when you're having your policy debates. So now with this kind of a grounding, let's move on to how these same concepts work in the law enforcement data arena. The biggest chunk of law enforcement data is classified under Minnesota Statute 1382. For agencies that perform a law enforcement function, which would include your city police, county sheriffs, fire departments, the state patrol, the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, some very special units in corrections, commerce, and human services that perform law enforcement functions. There is certainly a lot of data that gets collected and maintained by law enforcement. And if we apply our general presumption that everything is public, we would have a lot of public data. And what the legislature has instead done is provide a protection for active criminal investigations, and then also has a detailed description of when cases really are active and when they're not active. And when they're not active, for the most part, everything in those files becomes public, with certain exceptions. So, and to make sure, though, that not everything law enforcement had suddenly was classified as investigative data, you provided three big provisions that detail data that is always public, even when the case is active. So even when they are investigating my car business, and if there's an arrest, go to the sheet that says always public law enforcement data. When you look at that column of arrest data, time and place, resistance encountered, weapons used by the agency, the charge of which I'm placed under, whether or not I'm being held in custody, all these kinds of elements are public as soon as I'm arrested. And you have a reasonable amount of time to provide that. And what folks like the newspapers and other media folks will say is this data has always been public. And what folks say is in this electronic age, how is having this much public arrest data, how does it change how we think about it? A frequent question we get from law enforcement is whether or not can they withhold any arrest data. Say they've got a whole series of arrests that they're going to do and they don't want to tip off any of the bad actors. And the answer is no. Arrest data is always public, even when the case is active. And that always, they're like, really? Yes, really. And then we move into the next column, which is a request for service. And it's a much shorter list. And those are when members of the public call for help. So I go home, I see my neighbor's door is open, and I go inside. It seems really strange on a day like today for my neighbor's front door to be open. So I walk in, and I find my neighbor collapsed at the bottom of her stairs. So I call for help. Now, once the cops arrive, so I've made a request for service. So all these details about me and the situation I have found are going to be public. What was the nature of the request? And my neighbor looks dead, by the way, too. So I've just called in. I found my neighbor dead in her house. The fact that I have called and my address is going to be public as well. All I did was what, you know, a good person would do, go next door, try and give some help. It's still going to make that data about me public. And the response initiated by the agency, they sent a squad out immediately. That's going to be public. So that's that one piece. And then now law enforcement's going to respond to my request, and then you get this very long list of the response to that request for service. Or any, so say it wasn't I called them. Say they're just driving by and they see the door open and they go in. What's the response that they initiated as well? So all of these details as well, always public, even when the case is initiated. One of the things, there is one provision that allows this last column to be temporarily withheld if they believe public access to that data is going to endanger the safety of someone or allow a perpetrator to flee. But if I walk in and find my neighbor dead on the floor, there really is probably no concern for my safety. There's no real rationale to withhold that data from the public. It's just going to be public data immediately. We get a lot of calls from law enforcement, and I think it's more what makes people uncomfortable about others knowing. Is if I walk next door and it looks like my neighbor's committed suicide, we get a lot of calls around mental health calls like that. I've called in, I've found my neighbor, and it's a suicide, and all the details in that report is still, even though it's a suicide, it's not medical data, it's not covered by HIPAA, it's just response, or there's a request for service, and there's public response or incident data. So that really, I think, pulls at people's heartstrings and they feel very uncomfortable. But that is the policy decision that was made, that kind of data would be public to be able to ensure that we can hold law enforcement accountable and know what's occurring. And I think HIPAA is one of those other big ones too. HIPAA protects medical records that are provided that come from a medical provider. So if I tell my husband, he's going nuts, he's on these meds, there's nothing about that. Even though I know his medical information, the fact that I'm talking about a medical condition doesn't make it a medical record that's going to be protected by HIPAA. It's probably still going to just be straight-up response or request for service data. Subdivision 7 of 1382 provides that criminal investigative data for active investigations. And it details when something's going to be considered inactive. And we often have kind of a, I think law enforcement has sometimes different in viewpoint of when something is inactive. Often for them, when their investigation is all tied up and they've sent it over to the prosecutor for the consideration of charging, they feel like it's done for them. And the statute instead specifies that a case becomes inactive and that thus more data becomes public when the agency, so the law enforcement agency or the prosecutor, decides not to pursue the case. So you often see a decision not to charge and then everyone gets to see everything that's in the file, even the investigative data. The expiration of a time to bring a charge or the statute of limitations or 30 years, so that's another piece of it. And then the exhaustion of all rights of the appeal if someone's convicted. So if someone pleads guilty and there's still a time frame in which they can take it back, still the case isn't inactive yet. But you will have lots of data that gets presented in court that becomes public, even if it is active investigative data. You'll always have the stuff that's always public anyway, regardless of what point in the process it's at. On the list of response or incident data, you'll see that the names and addresses of victims and witnesses are public. On the backside, what you'll see is Subdivision 17 provides some instances where certain people's identities get protected. And I think it's surprising for many people to see that routinely most crime victims and most witnesses don't get any protection at all. So there are four instances where the identity has to be protected. An undercover law enforcement, a victim or alleged victim of crim sex, the identity of a person unlawfully removed from a cemetery, and folks who were at the legislature for a lot longer will have to explain where that part came from, and then the identity of a mandated reporter. Everything else, all the other identities, is a permissive protection, and oftentimes it is the law enforcement agency who's going to decide whether or not someone's identity is going to be protected or whether or not they need it. Now, as I earlier said, you need a law that allows data to get shared if it's not public. 1382 subdivision 24, Representative Holberg refers to this as the Mack truck exception, which it's kind of catchy, so I like it. It allows law enforcement agencies to share data with each other that they need to do when one of them is doing an investigation. And I think what Mr. O'Malley and Mr. Johnson are going to further highlight is there is a hole. So say I get, I'm in charge of St. Paul PD, I get a tip from the FBI in Wisconsin. They've got a certain investigation going on against some certain people. They say you might just want to be on the lookout. St. Paul PD has not initiated any kind of investigation. Any documentation I have of that tip from the other state or the feds doesn't have any protection here. And that is one hole that they probably will want to highlight for you, that we may need to have some vehicle to be able to protect the active investigations that are going on by other states or the feds, because I think there's been concern that other states and the feds will have less willingness to share with Minnesota if we can't adequately protect their active investigations. But oftentimes, Minnesota is just passively receiving data either from another law enforcement agency or from the public that just says, you should be on the lookout for this, and no investigation has yet been initiated. But I think that's probably a good segue to these guys, unless any of you have any specific other additional questions.
Any questions,
Did I cover
members?
Everything? Cover as much as you can possibly absorb in this amount of time.
Senator Foley?
Yes, Madam Chair, and Laura, I guess I'll use it. What I'm concerned about is expungement of records, and especially where you have no evidence to support the conviction, and the party was charged, and then the judges think they got authority to hide that, and they're not doing it. And tell me where are we on that?
Ms. Byer-Krupinski, you can answer that question specifically if you have the information. The larger question is, which is interesting, is you alluded to the fact that the judicial branch has their own data, I guess, restrictions. And so to the extent that you can maybe share a little bit of that, what you know with us, that would be good.
Madam Chair, Senator Foley, I think what the debate has been that because data is, you know, arrest data is public, it's kind of out the door. And then with the electronic age, how those kinds of issues then get resolved, even if there is an expungement at some later point, really kind of the genie is almost out of the bottle, and how are some of the vehicles going to be to address that with private companies that have legitimately purchased public data that then the courts or by law or by their own power want to be able to protect. There has certainly been case law and other situations around can the judicial branch seal executive branch records and that kind of ongoing debate. But the U.S. Supreme Court had this doctrine of practical obscurity. When data was a lot harder to get and it was sitting in a million little kind of file cabinets, they thought people had less of a privacy interest in that than when it was gathered all together. So what you'll see is arrest data at the local level will always be public. When it goes up and is booted up to a database of criminal history at the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, you've provided it with a private classification so that people can't get a data dump in one spot of all the arrest data. But it doesn't mean you can't get it from somewhere. So that has certainly been the policy debate that has been going on for a number of years of how do you address this? How do we maintain openness but still provide some protection for the unintended collateral consequences of an arrest, especially if it doesn't ever, didn't have probable cause, doesn't result in anything, or does get expunged.
Madam Chair.
Senator Foley.
What is the status on that insofar as dealing with an arrest and the party is acquitted? When he or she comes to get a job or do some of those things, under those circumstances, it might not be covered, if you will.
Madam Chair, Senator Foley, you're right. Even if there is no conviction ever, that arrest record is still going to be sitting out there. So that's been the policy debate. I don't know exactly where a number of the different expungement bills for this session are at yet. I haven't been following that very closely. But if you wanted me to get you more information about that, I certainly could.
Yes, Madam Chair. Laura, I agree with that. I gather, though, that I do know there have been cases that deal with that issue, and the you lost control by and large of your own data, and so that's a concern I have. We've had that on the juvenile and adult laws and the committee members on it, we had trouble with the files more than anything else. And it seemed to me that there was a St. Paul case where the party had to go to court to get a court order to get that expunged. And the overall feeling on the expungement seems to be that some people don't care. The police do care, and the courts don't care. So, and so you've got different people involved: county attorney and the public defender, and so forth.
Well, Senator Foley, I think that the issue of expungement certainly is an issue that in this committee we've talked about a number of sessions in a row. The reality of it is that I think the expungement as a tool is worthy and worthwhile for us to continue to talk about with respect to its potential assist to people who are experiencing very adverse collateral consequences. But I think what we've just heard today is that once that record is created, that record is created and it's out there. And I think that while expungement is a good goal for us to be going towards, the whole reason why we're having the conversation today is to say the informations are out there. And by merely expunging something, it doesn't systematically go throughout the whole system and just eliminate it, right? But that the information is still out there. So how do we manage that information? And I think that that's why we're having the conversation today, because it addresses exactly the issue that you've identified. Before you leave, I wonder if you could share one last thought with us about how is data privacy treated differently between juveniles and adults in the state, or is there no difference?
Madam Chair and members, 1382 covers, for the most part, adults. There's another section, 260B-171, that details law enforcement records of juveniles who get picked up. There are certainly lots. It's a very complicated area because many juveniles, as you know, don't get treated like juveniles anymore. So they get really, they're in the adult system almost exclusively, and more data about them is public. But generally speaking, under 260B, most data about children, both victims and witnesses and alleged perpetrators, are private data, so that the children and their parents can still gain access to it, but that the general public can't.
So you said that children are treated more like adults now. Who makes that determination, or did we identify that certain information with respect to children can be treated as adult information?
Madam Chair, remember, it's mostly in the criminal code as far as if you are, I'm not going to do it exactly, if you were a child who was over 14 and you commit an act that would be a felony if it was committed by an adult, you're going to be treated like an adult. So there are instances around certain crimes that you commit. And maybe Mr. Backus would like to answer some of those as well. But it really sometimes depends on the context in which the child is involved in the criminal justice system and how their data is going to get treated, either what activity they're doing, whether or not it's a child protection matter versus delinquency versus if they do something so serious that we've just decided criminally that they're going to just be treated as adults.
Well, we'll put Mr. Backus on notice that we'll come back to him for a longer answer on this question. Thank you so much. If the members don't have any questions, thank you very much. Superintendent O'Malley and Mr. Johnson. Superintendent, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Tim O'Malley. I'm the superintendent at the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. I'm joined by Director Dave Johnson, who oversees our Minnesota Justice Information Services Division. I just go?
Please.
Thank you for the opportunity, first of all. We've discussed this topic a number of times in and out of session, and I greatly appreciate the opportunity to come before the committee. You've asked us to provide a couple of things. One is just a broad overview to sort of set the stage, set the environment that we're living in today in terms of some of the databases that we have, and then we'll follow that up with Mr. Johnson. We'll talk about cybers. And that we'll talk about MnJAC, and we'll talk about the gang pointer system, the audit that was recently done. As far as the overview goes, I guess there's two points that I'd ask you to keep in mind, and they both deal with advancements or changes. One is in technology, and one is in the way criminals behave today compared to even just recently. Crimes, I think when people look back in a decade from now as to the criminal justice system and law enforcement in particular and say, what were the issues of the day that really made a difference? I think they'll look to forensic science, and I think they'll look to information sharing and information technology as the two booms that took place during this time frame and how we handled those. Forensics aside, we are in an information age. I think everybody would agree with that. And we are in an age where criminal activity crosses more jurisdictional lines than ever before. The role of technology and information sharing, there's been tremendous advancements, and those can affect public safety, can affect privacy, can affect accuracy of the records, can affect accountability. We are almost past, and we soon will be past, the age of paper reports and 3x5 index card files that people look up information in. It's all going to be in databases, and in many cases already is. But as Lori Beyer-Kapinski had pointed out, some of that information is still fragmented. It's still compartmentalized. That is the case still. A lot of these databases or a lot of these bits of information in the criminal justice system and certainly in law enforcement are fragmented in different areas. And part of what Mr. Johnson's division at the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension is to do with direction from the legislature and from the CrimNet Policy Group and Task Force is to try and integrate those so that information can be shared in a reasonable, accountable way. So that's the technology aspect of it, and as you mentioned in the expungement, just brief expungement discussion just a moment ago, this information's out there. If you haven't already, if you Google your own name, I think people are surprised at how much personal information is out there on them in the public sector to begin with. As far as criminal activity and some of the changes there, criminal activity continues to evolve, as it always has. There have been some rapid changes, though, and the pace of those changes has been very rapid. In terms of major criminal activities, major criminal organized activities, I'm not talking about an individual incident that a law enforcement agency will deal with. It may be that they could have all the information they need within the borders of their city or their county to solve that crime. However, while information in law enforcement is compartmentalized, the criminal organizations are not. Even the era from a decade ago of gang association has broken down some. The allegiance, the pure allegiance to gangs isn't what it used to be. It really is what crime has often been. It's really about the money. Whether you call it a gang member or whether you call it not a gang member, people who are engaged in cross-jurisdictional crimes are chasing the money. Drug dealing clearly cross-jurisdictional. It has to be. We have no poppy fields in Minnesota. It's an international crime to begin with. But drug dealing, some of the financial crimes now, some of the internet scams, they're crossing jurisdictions all the time. So if you have a series of burglaries in your town, and maybe they come to an end, or you have a series of sexual assaults, or the drug dealing, or the internet scams, and even crimes now in cyberspace. If you're not familiar with Second Life, it's a whole nother discussion, but criminals now are using this technology. There isn't an ability through this cyber world called Second Life where criminals can transfer money around the world in seconds that is almost indetectable. So law enforcement needs to react to that, and we need to share information so that we can detect, solve, and often prevent these crimes. So criminals are using these, and if there's an opportunity to increase the accuracy, which some of these databases can do, the completeness, and to enforce accountability in how that information is shared in a very transparent way to improve public safety, there's an opportunity to do that. One point I'd like to make is that while information is the core of solving any crime and often preventing a crime, this really, some of the discussions we're having, I don't think is about having more information. It's about smarter use of the information we already have. It's the information is there. How can we use it in a way that's effective, that is timely, and that is in a way that that it's monitorable and an audit trail is created so that if there is any abuse, it can be detected and dealt with. I mentioned before that if there's a series of burglaries, for example, we've had a case not too long ago where there was a series of burglaries in Minneapolis, and there was a certain MO, method of operation, if you will, of things, of the way it was done. And I know of another case where after the daytime burglaries, the person always took a chair out to the fence and left the chair there, and that's how they climbed over the fence. So they've left their signature, if you will. Then it stops. You know, experience would teach us one of two things probably happened. It's unlikely they just gave up criminal activity. I suppose three things could have happened. But in my cynical world, one of two things probably. Either they got locked up, and that's why there's no more of these kinds of burglaries, or they moved to a new location. And we had one not long ago where there was a series of burglaries in Minneapolis, and they just stopped. Everybody's like, oh, you know, I wonder what happened there. Well, we found out that they went up to Mille Lacs. And if we had the ability to share that information to say, hey, here's what they're doing here. Well, they, for whatever reason, they detected things were hot or there was an informant. They decided to move to another location in the state and continue that criminal activity. So now when you compare those things, maybe somebody knew there was a blue pickup, somebody else knew this, you could maybe solve that crime and prevent further burglaries by sharing that information. Very simplistic example, but it's a very real one. A more extreme example, and I'll offer this, even though the last time I did it, I was accused immediately afterwards of being a fear-mongerer and asked why am I not showing the autopsy photos to shock everybody. But this is the big 9/11 story. And I don't offer this to say this is going to happen every day, but as the other extreme for real simple day-to-day law enforcement activity of sharing information, the 9/11 one was a situation here in Minnesota where there was a man, a French citizen, taking lessons in Eagan on how to fly a plane. And the person running that school came to law enforcement and said, I find something very curious here. This man has no interest in learning how to land a plane. He said, I've never had a student without worrying about how to get safely on the ground. Very interested in how to operate a plane when it's in the air. But when it comes time to learn about the rest of it, doesn't study, doesn't do anything. This is odd. It is. Now, at the same time, the FBI in Phoenix had some more detailed information about a potential plot using planes that would crash into buildings. And there was information somewhere else. Could that have been prevented? God only knows. But is there an advantage to comparing some of this information in a responsible, accountable way so that maybe crimes like that could be prevented, or once they occur, they can be solved more readily, which, again, actually prevents further crimes down the road? The ability to use information databases and sharing information is simply a tool. It's a law enforcement tool like any other tool, I would suggest. And if there are ways to use that and establish standards and hear concerns and do it in a transparent way, we've talked about MNJAC, and I'll talk about that in a little bit, but that's an opportunity, a vehicle or an entity that can help share this information in a way that is accountable. But if there are abuses of a law enforcement tool, They have to be dealt with, and there have to be serious consequences. I'll give you one example of a time when that did occur. We had a law enforcement officer, licensed law enforcement officer here in Minnesota a couple of years ago, who accessed driver's license photos for the purpose of providing those photos to drug dealers. And the photos he accessed were those of BCA agents who were working in an undercover capacity. He knew them personally. He was able to access their driver's licenses and provided those to drug dealers. That person's in federal prison today, that law enforcement officer, which is where he should be. It's a tool. Nobody's suggesting we should do away with driver's license photos because of an abuse. But when it is abused, there have to be swift and real consequences, and that's that can be put in place if we work on this together. That's a real quick overview, and I would turn to Dave Johnson to talk about cybers, if that would be okay with you, Madam Chair.
Senator Foley.
Can you tell me, Superintendent, what about the collateral consequences? It seems to me that that's a significant problem, and one that that police especially are dealing with. You know, and yes, it's nice to have the file here that documents it. Person around a shopping area at 2 o'clock in the morning or something of that nature, but if you were that person, why, you might not think it was a good idea. Or if you have something that's got an additional consequence, that one of the things that we find, even the judges don't have records on many collateral consequences.
Superintendent.
Madam Chair and Senator Foley, I agree collateral consequences are of serious concern. Any database or any tool the law enforcement use, there has to be a balance of a risk and a benefit. There are risks in anything we do. Can it be abused? Sure. Could we put in the very best security measures we can so that people don't hack in or access these? Is it foolproof? You know, we hope so. We stay with it. We keep making changes because the criminals keep making changes. If there is an abuse, if someone uses it for an improper purpose, if they run a check in cybers or in another database and then provide it to someone for a non-law enforcement use, we have a division at the BCA that audits that, that we look at that, and we make sure that it's a random audit, that we say, hey, you accessed this criminal. What's the purpose for it? Show it the file. And if they didn't do that, then we actually are responsible to the FBI and to the federal system because some of that is based on their records as we check other states. So it is. It's a cost-benefit analysis that has to go on with everything. I would agree with you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel.
Superintendent O'Malley, Ms. Barr-Krupinski talked about the fact that the reason why we started passing these data laws in the first place is because some government agencies, including law enforcement agencies, were collecting a lot of information on private citizens and over-collecting information that, you know, maybe they shouldn't be having, private dossiers. It seems to me that in this electronic age, it's easier to collect and maintain more and more information, whether it's needed or not, with the idea that, well, someday we might need it and someday, you know, and I think that's a troublesome trend. And I've worked, for instance, on the pawn shop issue. I mean, any citizen who goes to a pawn shop, we have a whole database there. They're going to collect all kinds of information, whether they need it or not, with the idea that they're going to catch some criminals. And, you know, in a few instances, they might, but property is being fenced all the time, all over the place. So I'm just wondering how much of this is going on, and you know, how do we exercise any kind of oversight to figure out how much you're collecting and do you really need to be doing what you're doing?
Superintendent.
Madam Chair and members, there is a lot of information out there, and people are gathering it, both in the public sector and in the private sector. It's impossible to walk into a store today without being on video and having your license plate captured and getting an email later offering you something because your receipt from the store shows you like to buy these kinds of things. I mean, it's just going on. I agree. In law enforcement, this information is there. It's there. We're not going to, when somebody calls, And I'm not talking about the pawn shop, but when somebody calls law enforcement and says, as Lori Byer-Kaminsky pointed out, I looked in my neighbor's house and there's something suspicious going on. We have that information. The question isn't whether we have it, it's how should it be classified. And I think there is a way to share information that is involved in active criminal investigations, not just because we'd like to have information, but it is an active criminal investigation. And my concern is an ability to share that information very timely so that those investigating crimes can prevent them or solve the ones that are there. Are there other databases? Is there other information that may come to law enforcement? Sure, and then I think if it isn't part of an active criminal investigation, it's public, and people can have it. But I don't think we should say, don't even give us the information. If it's public, then people can get it and see what it is and challenge it if need be.
But, Mr. Superintendent.
Senator Betzel.
If it's classified as investigative data, it's not public information. And the difference between people who go down and voluntarily give out their information, because they go to a home and garden show and they fill out some forms because they think they're going to win a TV set or whatever. I mean, they do that voluntarily. Government can compel us to disclose data about ourselves, and it can be all forms, whether it's on the driver's licenses, our tax returns, anything else, where we can be required to do that. And I'm just concerned that there just might be some over collection of data that we're required to disclose that, and I just don't know what kind of databases are, we're all in and who's collecting the information and who's got access to it. At some point, a legislative oversight, has to be meaningful, but it can't be meaningful if we're told, well, it's all confidential. We can't really disclose what we're doing. So there's a disconnect here.
Superintendent?
Madam Chair, I don't know that there is a way to determine whether there's a criminal investigation going on. And if it is abused, then that can be dealt with, I guess, Senator. I don't know that I can speak from experience that law enforcement isn't interested in just gathering a whole bunch of data to have it. There's too much out there to deal with. It's more of a way of sorting it and being able to access what is really needed to solve a crime. I understand your concern. I'm not unsympathetic. I mean, I have the same concerns. If people are suspecting me of something that I didn't do, I would want to know about that. On the other hand, if there's a basis for it, if there's some reason to suspect it, there is a time needed to sort through that and determine whether this is a full-blown crime or, hey, it's just a quirky thing that this O'Malley guy is doing and it's nothing more than that.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Superintendent O'Malley, I've had a chance to think a little bit about since the before session presentations that we heard, some of the information that you presented are kind of the big picture. And so I just want to make a few observations or from my personal experience just in thinking about this. But the first thing I wanted to respond to is what you said about 9/11, because in the bigger picture, I understand the proposition that's being put forth by law enforcement kind of nationwide to have a third class of storing data was kind of came from the concerns we have over national security. And yet the proposition that we saw was for storing a lot of other kinds of data that don't necessarily have anything to do with national security. And so I'd like to have a little bit more information or a better understanding of what you said about 9/11, because that often gets thrown out there, as a reason why we have to do things differently than we did in the past. But I wonder if this third category of classification is really what's needed, or if what happened there was kind of a breakdown within the systems that actually existed already. I mean, because it almost seemed from what you were saying that there was somehow an inability for the FBI to share that information between different locations, and I would be surprised if that's really, unless I misunderstood you, if that's the case. I would think that there would have been that ability there, but maybe the systems just weren't working the way they should have been, from what I've read and heard about it. So that's one point, unless I misunderstood you, that I'd appreciate a little clarification over. And then a second kind of similar point, because as you know, I sit on the Financial Crimes Task Force, and once again, I'm just questioning whether it's additional information or another category we really need, or if we just need to be doing a better job of handling that information in a more sophisticated way. As you, and I think you've shared that concern with me, that you've had that concern as well, you know, that we don't want to be storing information in paper boxes, that when criminals are using very sophisticated methods online to commit these crimes, but I'm not sure that we need a different category to get that information. We just need to handle it and process it in a much more sophisticated way. And then the last observation, this is maybe a little bit off point, but when you're talking about having access to information, I would just make a plug for trying to get that information in a better way out to victims of crimes, because what I've seen before I came to the legislature was a hesitancy from law enforcement to share information by calling something part of an active file. And I think the law kind of changed back and forth on a little bit on what information had to be made available to victims. And I'll give you a specific example. Someone's been in an accident caused by a drunk driver, and they need to know if that person was served at a bar somewhere as part of an investigation to assist the victim. But they can't get that information through the county attorney's office or from law enforcement because they can't get that paper information. But they can pay and go interview at an expense the officer involved in the investigation. That just seems wrong to me.
Well, Senator Olson, I think that the 9/11 conversation the two of you can have with each other, I think that the superintendent used that as an example of where data sharing could have been helpful, but maybe not. And I think that part of the reason why we're meeting as the full Senate Judiciary Committee to talk about data is some of the issues that you've talked about. I think Ms. Byer-Krupinski made it very clear. If we don't like some of the data stuff that's happening out there, it's our responsibility to think this through and to change that. And so I appreciate the superintendent coming to us to give us some context to help us think about this. The reason why we're having this hearing is that I think as members of the legislature, it is our responsibility to understand very clearly this new reality that we're living in with the both passive and active collection of data and information, both for for health and non-public safety, non-criminal oriented information, but lots and lots of law enforcement information too. And I just think that it's important for us as committee members to understand where law enforcement is coming to us. But ultimately, I think we bear the responsibility to assess the situation and to rethink what information gets collected. Where? How is it categorized? Who can have that information? What goes into a database? What should come out of a database? Who should have access to those databases? Who should be sharing those databases? I think that that's our job to do that in this committee. And so I hope that with law enforcement's perspective and input to create a context that we would engage in that conversation in this committee. Because what I am hearing up until now is that lots of information is being created, lots of data is being created both actively and passively, and I think that there's a need for us to rethink that, and perhaps to the extent that we need to help reclassify or address the issue of how to deal with the data that's out there. And so I think that that's appropriately within our responsibility to do that. Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, thank you, and Superintendent O'Malley. I understand you're collecting information on a particular person that's suspected of whatever. What about their friends or their associates or their family members? I mean, do you get information about that when they have a contact with someone, do you then, are you able to look up information on that person, or is that part of the data collection as well, the information?
Superintendent?
Madam Chair and members, in the normal course of investigation, no, you wouldn't do that unless there was a reason to. If you had reason to suspect there was some that we've had crimes before where parents were involved with their children in criminal activity, or a neighbor was involved with some. I mean, that has happened. We did a drug case not long ago. Well, it's been a while since I was on the street, but we did a drug case where it was both parents and four of the kids were all drug dealers. That's what they did for a living. So yeah, then you would have information on each other. And I'm not talking about going out and actually collecting information. I'm saying this is the information that is there. Either we've collected it as part of a criminal investigation and done that responsibly, or it's information that comes to us, maybe from another state, maybe from a citizen who calls in and says, I have a concern about my neighbor. They're getting up at 2 in the morning and going out to their garage. Every night at 2 in the morning, staying out there for 15 minutes, and I see a flashlight, and then they go in. Okay. People are allowed to be quirky. People are allowed to be let alone, to do things. But on the other hand, what if that neighbor then says, but I think they have something out there. Law enforcement should follow up on that in some way. Again, maybe not a full-blown criminal investigation, but they should look in. And there's varying degrees of that, of people calling in with, you know, we have to get back to Senator Olson's point, and I think, Madam Chair, I think you hit it right on the head. My offer of the 9/11 example wasn't an intel data classification purpose. I hadn't been talking about that at all. I was just trying to give the overview. It was the connect the dots thing that you were referring to. And whether those data, I'm just talking about, we have databases that are compartmentalized. Part of what we try to do, and it was really to set the stage when we talk about MnJack, there is a way now that we have technology to be able to connect those dots. We'd be able to do that. Are they always doing it? You know, the attempted bombing on Christmas Day would tell us they're still not maybe successful. But there is an ability in Minnesota for just individual criminal activity, these burglars that move around, to be able to connect that a little better. I'm not talking about gathering more or looking at other people, but just what we already have as part of active criminal investigations.
Madam Chair?
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, if I might, I don't want to belabor the 9/11 thing, but I found that extremely, just as a citizen, really frustrating to know that somebody did connect some dots and there was something there, mm-hmm. and we couldn't do anything with it. And that, if that happened today, would the result be the same? You think?
Superintendent?
Somebody connected the dots today?
Well, Madam Chair, I can tell you from going to some briefings on terrorism and security, there have been a number of at least planned terrorist activities that have been thwarted.
Sure.
And when you think about what happened since 9/11, it hasn't happened again. That's phenomenal. Now, the Christmas Day event was one that after the fact, just reading the media, you would see that there were you know, the parents showed up somewhere and said, listen, there's somebody else said something else. And it was in defense of that is we do have, as I said, we have the technology to try and do some of that. And a computer can do it in a more neutral way than a person. They're not looking through cards. So if you can let the computers do a little bit. But part of it is this information age, it's like trying to get a sip of water out of a fire hydrant that's open. I mean, there's this information just after the fact you'd look and say, wait a minute, the father went in and this happened there? These are 3 points and nobody put it together? Well, wait till you see the millions of bits of information that we get that sometimes connect, sometimes don't. And then there's the flip side of it. This person, what if they were just quirky? What if he wasn't going to play? There's a lot of information that comes in and you know, you're cautious to not invade somebody's privacy or not hassle them, not go to their neighbors where they might start saying, well, why are they asking about him? So there's that balance that constantly has to go on.
Thank you.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Superintendent O'Malley. The point you made just raises the response I make to that is just I understand the importance of the need to connect the dots, but when you talked about computers, you know, there's kind of a plus and a minus side to that because on the one hand, yes, it can do the job much more quickly and perhaps, you know, less subjectively in analyzing a lot of data. On the other hand, you're kind of removing the element of common sense and somebody looking at something and using their own intellect to weigh whether something's as significant as, or the level of importance it should be treated with and maybe getting a false sense of security that somehow the computer's going to make those connections with you. So I guess in looking at how we design, and again, I don't know if that's that we need another way to store data, just how sophisticated, you know, what system we use with the data we already have. And I guess I would just argue that we probably need some of both, because we don't want to totally be relying on computers to decide if there's something that may not even connect, but we can apply our common sense to know that we need to do something about it.
And with that, why don't we hear about the systems that we do have, Mr. Johnson?
Thank you, Senator Moore, Madam Chair, and members. And if I might just very quickly digress for just 1 second, Senator Olson had asked a question earlier about the right of victims to get access to information from law enforcement on investigations. And that's already been contemplated by the legislature, and it's part of 1382. And I apologize, I don't remember the right subparagraph. But any time a victim of a crime on an ongoing investigation has need for that data, they can make an application to the prosecutor. And if the prosecutor reasonably determines that it won't conflict with the outcome of the case or compromise the investigation, they can order that the data be released in order that the victim pursue either an insurance claim or some other legitimate use of that information. So that already exists. I thought that might help you out, Senator.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, I'm really aware of that law. And I used to have those arguments with prosecutors who still refused to give it to me, and they wouldn't as a practical matter because they weren't required to with the change of the law. But yet you could go and pay the law enforcement person who was involved in the accident a fairly hefty fee and get the same information. And so that's why I'm objecting to the change in the law. I don't think the prosecutor – I think the onus should be on the prosecutor, as it used to be before we changed the law, to have to really make a case to keep it private, and it should flow more freely to victims when they need that information.
Senator Olson,
that's kind of a separate issue, maybe. But
well, no, I'm confused about paying a fee to law enforcement to get information.
Madam Chair, law enforcement is allowed to interview with victims outside of their normal working hours, and then they set the fee for what they're charging for that interview fee. So the victim is actually having to pay to get information.
Superintendent, is that true?
I don't know that a law enforcement officer could disclose information if a prosecutor said you need to withhold that information for some legitimate law enforcement or prosecutorial reason. Now, a police officer could be called as a witness in a civil case outside of their normal scope of employment and then be compensated for that, I suppose. I've never been involved in one of those situations when I worked on the street.
Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
This happens routinely, and it's not calling them as a witness in a say, to a court case where you're taking them away from the day. It's just simply talking to them to get the information that you need to proceed to with an investigation, say on the civil side or something. So it's a fairly lucrative sort of there's a considerable amount of money involved in what's charged for this. And, you know, it may be a little bit far off the topic of what we're talking about today, but if this is something that the committee is interested, I'd be happy to get some more details for you about how this practice is used and the way that it impacts victims.
Details would be helpful. Thank you, Senator Olson. Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair and members, I'm here to talk briefly on CIBRS, Comprehensive Incident-Based Reporting System. As you may recall, CIBRS was created by the legislature and the Legislative Act in 2005 under Minnesota Statute 299C40. What is CIBRS? CIBRS is a statewide database of incident information from Minnesota law enforcement agencies' records management systems. It is available only to Minnesota law enforcement personnel. And I think that's an important spot to pause at to make sure that we understand that CIBRS only receives data that has already been created and put into the record system of sheriff's departments and law enforcement agencies in the state of Minnesota. It does not exist separately, and it cannot be entered separately. It can only receive data from those systems. So in essence, it is not the sole source for any information. What it really does is brings together that information on a statewide basis from those agencies that participate and makes it available for investigative purposes to law enforcement. So what is law cyber is used for? By statute, it is an investigative tool. The law authorizing cyber restricts how it is used and only in criminal investigations and for conducting background investigations for licensed peace officers seeking employment. Cyber contains calls for service or incident information that can be very useful to determine whether other agencies have had similar incidents, dealt with similar situations, or even had similar suspects. Cyber is only available to Minnesota law enforcement agencies. State law restricts use to specific Minnesota law enforcement agencies, including municipal police departments, Metropolitan Transit Police, Metropolitan Airport Police, University of Minnesota Police, County Sheriff's Department, Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, and the Fugitive Unit of the Department of Corrections and the Minnesota State Patrol. Cybers cannot be used for civil uses or anything other than criminal investigations for which that agency has a responsibility to prosecute or to solve the crime. I think those are all important issues to understand. So who has access to cybers? It can only be accessed through the Secure Criminal Justice Data Network, which is operated by the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. It's all in an encrypted network. Each agency that wishes to access and contribute data must have a user agreement that's approved by the Department of Administration and by the BCA. Anybody who is using the information or accessing has to go through a training class, has to be certified, and has to have a record of accomplishing that level of training. So how do we prevent the misuse of cybers? First of all, the cybers, again, is restricted, the use, to those statutorily approved reasons. Secondarily, the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension and the Auditing Division of the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension audits on a regular basis the use and access to cybers. We have the responsibility to audit all criminal justice agencies operating on the Criminal Justice Data Network. We do that. We visit every agency at least once every 3 years. Those agencies that are approved to either put in data to cybers or to access data, we take a random sample of those accesses and we make sure that it's been done appropriately, that they have the appropriate audit trail, and that they can link that access back to an ongoing criminal investigation or a background investigation. Additionally, that data are audited for accuracy, and if, in fact, we find errors or egregious mistakes, either through access or through the entering of that data, there are sanctions that can occur, up to including, if it's a willful violation, penalties under Minnesota Statute 1309, which is a misdemeanor offense reaching the level for doing either a suspension or termination of the employee. There's also civil penalties under 1308 and the possibility of having that agency or those individuals removed from access to the system. At the present time, we have 101 law enforcement agencies contributing data to cybers. We have 109 law enforcement agencies that can access data to cybers, and we have somewhere in the neighborhood of 200,000 records in the cyber system presently. We are currently working with some of the larger agencies that are about to contribute data to cybers, including Brooklyn Park, including Eden Prairie, Ramsey County Sheriff's Department, Hennepin County, Minneapolis PD, and St. Paul PD. Clearly, the value of cybers, again, is it's taking data that has already been collected. And I think that's really important to understand, that that data is existing in law enforcement systems already in the state of Minnesota. It's not collected especially for cybers. It's not in a special format for cybers. The cybers interface takes that data from those law enforcement agencies, from a minimum of 6 fields to a maximum of 126 fields of data, and then makes it accessible to those authorized users in the hope that one of those pieces of information will assist that law enforcement agency in identifying a perpetrator of a crime or solving an investigation for a crime that has already taken place.
Mr. Johnson, of all the users who have access to cybers, Did you say they're all local law enforcement agencies?
Senator Ma and members, that is correct.
And then of the, when you said that there's a periodic audit, how often is that?
Senator Ma and members, that is at least once every 3 years.
And then how do you measure accuracy?
Madam Chair and members, we measure accuracy by looking at the report, which was the source of that information, and to ensure that it was translated the same way it was on the report into the system.
And so when you find something, a record that is problematic with accuracy, what do you do with it?
Madam Chair and members, if we found one that was inaccurate, it would be removed from the system. I think it would be important to note that there are no narratives in the system. The narrative portion of an incident report is not included. What's included are some of the relative facts and data associated with that. Where did the incident take place? Who was involved? What kind of vehicles were they driving? Who were the individuals that were with them? What was the generic nature of the case? But there are none of the narrative portions of that incident are available. So if, in fact, a legitimate inquiry was made into the cyber system and the data proved to be valuable, it would identify where the source was for that data, and then the investigating officer would have the opportunity to contact that agency to get further information if warranted.
Please proceed.
Madam Chair, that is what I had to present in regard to cybers, and certainly would stand for any questions that the Chair or members might have.
Well, Mr. Johnson, with respect to cybers, you know, we're going to move to talk about the gang pointer file system, and the gang pointer file system, the legislature provides a set of criteria that acts as sort of the threshold, right, before somebody can get forwarded to be included in the pointer file system. Do we prescribe anything like that statutorily for the cybers database?
Madam Chair and members, yes, you do. We would do it as far as an audit. We would make sure that the agency itself had a signed and functioning user agreement. We would ensure that it was operating on the criminal justice data network. We would ensure that the individuals who are accessing the system, if you had a police agency, Madam Chair, that had 60 police officers, we would ensure that all 60 police officers that are accessing the system have a separate user ID and that they have done the training required by. We would then look at their individual transactions, and we would then ask that agency to pull the case file that generated that access to ensure it was for legitimate criminal investigation purposes.
So there isn't a set of criteria in the user agreement to say that you could enter this information if this file meets the set of benchmarks. Is that correct?
Madam Chair and members, we build an interface that sets those parameters up and establishes the data that the agency may be collecting, that the basic fields, and then we bring it into the system, and those things are taken care of by the translation through the technology.
So there isn't a set of criteria that governs the discretion of the individual who is entering, choosing to take a particular file and entering it in, right? You only deal with making sure that the information that you're getting is the information that they have, but unlike the gang pointer file system, where we spell out to say a person may only be put in the gang pointer file system if they have done A, B, C, D, or E, there isn't anything like that in the books to govern who gets entered into the cybers database. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, you are correct. The cybers system at the present time, whether an agency wishes to participate or not participate is discretionary on their part. Whether they choose to send us all of their records or some of their records is discretionary on their part. What I'm speaking of is that when they do send a record, we audit it to make sure that the record has integrity and so forth. But in fact, they can choose to send all of their records or just some of their records.
So, Mr. Johnson, of the 101 agencies that do participate, can you give us an estimate of how many of them send 100% of their records, or do the majority of them do 100% of their records, or is it half and half?
Madam Chair and members, I don't know what the percentage would be, but I don't believe we have a single agency that's sending us 100% of their records. When the records first come, an agency has the ability to mark it as confidential, which means that record would not be made available to the subject of the record for a statutorily defined period of 120 days. On the 110th day, that agency has to renew the confidential status, that it's still an ongoing investigation regarding that case. It can only be confidential if it's an ongoing investigation. If they do not renew it, that entry then becomes private. So most of the data that is in the cyber system is classified by Chapter 13 as private data on an individual, and that individual can go to any location or the BCA that's a member of Cybers, ask to see the data that Cybers may have on them, and they will get a printout of what agencies have contributed data on them, who the responsible authorities are, what their phone number is, and how they can go actually see the full entries of the information.
And then a final question, because I think you answered this already, but Cybers is not accessible to federal agencies or to other state agencies. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, members, that's correct.
Okay. Any other questions for Mr. Johnson on the Cybers database? Very good. Please proceed.
Madam Chair, that's my portion of this presentation.
All right.
Madam Chair, I think what I had next was that you wanted to have a real quick overview of MNJAC and its role in information sharing.
Yes.
The MNJAC is the Minnesota Joint Analysis Center. It is a fusion center, as it's referred to generically around the United States. It serves several purposes, and most of it is to share information in an effort to keep Minnesotans safe, is what it comes down to. It serves as the point of contact for other states and the federal government in two ways, for information coming to Minnesota and for information maybe going out that can relate to public safety. And I'll give you an example of each. There was a case not long ago in which an Army recruiter in Texas, I believe, I know it was a faraway state, was working online with a teenager in Minnesota, recruiting that person to maybe join the Army. During that online conversation, the teenager here in Minnesota expressed some suicidal tendencies. And the recruiter, at the end of that communication, was concerned, knew the student was, or the teenager was in Minnesota, and didn't know where to turn in Minnesota to try and sort that out. So that Army recruiter contacted their fusion center in Texas, who in turn contacted ours here and said, here's what we have. Here's the information we have on the person. Here's the name. We don't know exactly where they are, but they're talking suicide. Our MNJAC then, because they know Minnesota and law enforcement and who to contact, and they checked, they identified who the person was. They contacted the local law enforcement agency. They went out to the home of the parents and found them and had the parents go to the school. And within 1 hour of that initial call, the parents and a counselor were meeting with that student. Absent this kind of a one-stop shop in order to get information to figure out where it should go in this information age, as we say, all this stuff comes in. All right, where should we go? Rather than make 10 phone calls and leave a voice recording, here's a spot you know you can turn to try to get information to the right people in Minnesota that might affect the safety of Minnesotans. The flip side, and this isn't a Minnesota case, but it's a case out of Sacramento, California. A three-year-old was abducted by a person who had been convicted of rape and murder of children in the past, and they knew that the person was probably going to leave the country, or they had information the person might be leaving the country. They went to their fusion center, who has a connection with the Department of Homeland Security, and said, here's what we know about the person. They put a lookout on, and they ended up arresting the person when he got off a plane in Amsterdam by working through Interpol and the FBI. They'd have LEGAT offices there and do that. Now, these are extreme cases, but that's the kind of sharing of information that can happen very quickly in today's world that in the past probably wouldn't have been possible. That's one role that MNJAC plays, is to share information and make sure the right people get it. A second role that they play is to put out to law enforcement updates on major events, and almost all that comes from public information anyway. A good example is on Christmas Day. I got a series of pages and then emails with information about the attempted bombing, with the idea that law enforcement around the country suddenly get to a heightened alert. Is this something that has any connection to Minnesota? This was over Detroit. Could it be with us? The first reports were, no, this appears to be isolated. There's no reason to get ramped up. Go back to your Thanksgiving or to your Christmas dinner, you know, that type of thing. Or the other side might have been, hey, we do have some leads in Minnesota that could be related to an event in another city. We may need to contact people. So it's just, rather than have maybe 87 sheriffs and 450 chiefs of police trying to figure this out and watching CNN or doing whatever they can to figure if there's something they might have to do, it's a single stop. It's just, you get a quick one paragraph saying, hey, this is what's going on in this major event in another area of the United States. Either step down or we may have some leads in your area of the state. Another thing they do is to provide, do a little research and provide, again, mostly from open source information on latest scams and schemes and criminal trends. They've done them recently on financial crime that puts out to all kinds of law enforcement. They did one recently on threatening letters that were being sent to banks, and they were threatening a certain type of action against the bank if they didn't take a different type of action. And they had an example of that. They put it out to law enforcement, and within a short period of time, a bank in Rochester called their law enforcement, hey, I just got this letter, you know, through an internet, so I got this email threatening this. Law enforcement knew what this was about, knew how to respond, and knew whether there was credibility to it or not, and at least had the ability to give them advice. They also work active criminal investigations. They provide analytical support on these cross-jurisdictional investigations, mostly when they involve something outside the metro or smaller agencies that don't have the resources to do that. And then lastly, they assist on major events. The most recent one was the Hells Angels run over the summer up in Carlton County. I think they have 19 deputies. The sheriff up there was very concerned about it. She contacted us. We helped with getting information from other states on past Hells Angels runs, how they go about doing this. There was also a lot of concern that Minnesota is a Hells Angels territory, if you weren't aware of that. This is where one of their home bases. Wisconsin is an Outlaws motorcycle gang territory. So this was in Carlton. There's a border there. They actually had people gathering at a campground in Wisconsin, the Outlaws, and we had people in Minnesota with the Hells Angels, and there was concern that if they met, it would be an ugly situation. So there was just an ability to put together a command post, monitor that, make sure we knew everything that was going on, and actually had a number of meetings with the leaders from the Hells Angels and leaders from the Outlaws with law enforcement one-on-one, sitting down with them, telling them this is what our concerns are and doing that kind of thing. MnJAC helped coordinate that. The last thing I would mention is that I know there's rightfully so very strong concerns about privacy and how information can be used and collateral consequences. A privacy committee was formed here in Minnesota a couple years ago. Representatives from the media, in fact, Mark Anfinson, I think, is still sitting behind me trying to make sure that nobody saw him so he wouldn't be called up to testify, but I think he's here. Bob Zikora, defense bar, was there. Chuck Samuelson from the ACLU, prosecutors, law enforcement, others all got together and looked at our data practices law and looked at what MnJAC is doing and made sure that as information flowed in and out of MnJAC, we were fully compliant with Chapter 13. And we did that intentionally to put people around the table with different, you know, divergent viewpoints on this to make sure everybody was heard. And we have a privacy committee that still meets, and we have a privacy policy that is public and has been shared with everyone.
Superintendent, the information that's created at MnJAC, is that considered a database? I mean, are you maintaining information in some format?
It would be only for the information that is used for when they're assisting on analytical work on a multi-jurisdictional criminal investigation. A financial crime, for example, that several law enforcement agencies contact and say, here's what we have, and they help compile that. There would be a database for that. Everything else, I think, that I mentioned would just be public. Some of the bulletins that they put out to law enforcement, that's just information on crime trends, and some of that gets shared with anyone who wants it.
And then do we have agreements with the federal government and or international governments to do the kind of multi-jurisdictional work that you're talking about that goes beyond the state of Minnesota through the Fusion Center?
I don't know if we have a formal agreement. We do have, and every state has, the option of sharing information with the federal government or not providing that information. And it actually raises a concern that we've discussed about the classification of that data, not so much when it's we have the option of putting something out there for them to have, but we do want to have the ability in Minnesota to have other states or to have the federal government provide us with information without them being concerned that because of our data practices law, and it's what Lori Byer-Kopinski referred to, that information may come into Minnesota that we don't have an active criminal investigation on it, but maybe Iowa does. And because we don't have an active criminal investigation on it, and if we were asked, would we have to disclose that and maybe harm their criminal investigation? So one discussion was whether we should have an ability to classify the information coming into Minnesota to respect the classification they have on it. Again, not information that we've created, only information that could come to us.
So do we or have we entered an agreement to share information with the federal government?
I'm not aware of a formal agreement. Are you, Dave, that we have with MNJAC?
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair and members, when the Privacy Policy Committee was working and prior to that in the discussions, a number of lawyers looked at the various exchanges that might be possible, and all of the exchanges are done within the confines of law. So they're provided by law itself, but there are no formal agreements memorializing that. They're all done within regard to existing law.
Any other questions? Senator Lummer?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Superintendent O'Malley, when one collects data considered as criminal intelligence, could that possibly be data that doesn't necessarily point to a crime? Is one accumulating data with the idea that as you collect it, it eventually will become information that will lead to a criminal charge? The point that I'm trying to get at is where do we draw the line between suspicious activity versus actual criminal activity? And where does criminal intelligence define those two things?
Superintendent?
Madam Chair and members, Senator Lerman, that's the exact point that we had the discussion about at the BCA on where do you draw that line. Right now the line is clear. It is if it's an active criminal investigation, then it is confidential data and government doesn't share it. If it is merely a suspicion and there's not a sufficient amount to say you're actively investigating it, then it's public data. And that is a concern. That's the discussion we've had in the past about whether there should be an intelligence classification. There is not one now. When you say as we gather criminal intelligence, there is no such thing in law today. We do get that information. Somebody calls and says this is going on, but if we're not actively investigating it, then that is public information.
But Superintendent, the act of saying an active investigation is contingent on a triggering event that will make it an active investigation, right? I mean, you can't just sit down and say, I'm going to open a file on Senator Warren Limmer. I mean, you consider active.
You should.
Oh, they've already got a file cabinet.
You should. I mean, it is contingent on there being a triggering event that would lead to the active investigation that's related to that event. Is that correct?
Yes. There has to be a basis. There has to be a criminal predicate. There has to be a reason other than a hunch. There has to be a reason that either you believe a crime occurred, you know, maybe there was a bank robbery and you don't know who committed it, so you have an active criminal investigation with nobody's name in it. Or it may be that you have sufficient information to say this person has committed a crime, but you don't know where that crime occurred. Maybe you have very reliable information that this person has robbed a bank, but you're not sure which one or in which state. So you may open an investigation on them, but you can't just do it because one phone call says, I've got a weird neighbor. And it is a bit ill-defined, Senator. I mean, it's been described as the Mack truck exception on the one hand, because law enforcement say I have an active criminal investigation. But when they get questioned on it, if it's not, it's not, and that is public information.
Madam Chair?
Senator Lamar?
Superintendent, you said that if it wasn't a direct criminal activity for intelligence gathering, then it would be considered public data. But that precipitates that you're collecting data on individuals that may not be a criminal activity in nature. Is that where you were going with it? Are we collecting data on just a report from somebody that someone doesn't like the activities of a neighbor or someone, and then that would be written down and memorialized somewhere, and then someone could access that because it's public data? Or is it just the subject of that data would be open for that?
Superintendent?
Madam Chair and Senator Limmer, it might be more accurate to use the word received as opposed to collected. I guess it's a fine line, but we constantly, law enforcement constantly receives information. It's not that they're even necessarily going out and asking for it. Although, if you look at community watch groups, we tell people, we go out and train citizens that if you see something suspicious, call law enforcement. Please call us. Now, we don't necessarily go out and say, you know, watch this person, but call us. So if they call, I think law enforcement has a responsibility to accept that call and to log what it is they say. Now, that information may come in, and maybe it's, you know, every law enforcement agency probably has their Gladys Kravitz, I think, is the one from Bewitched, for those of us of that age, who calls about everything. And you know, to take it with a grain of salt, that probably there's no real problem here. On the other hand, you have some people that will call in and say something, and you don't know whether this is criminal activity or whether this is just something unusual and there's no. So there is a time there when you may be looking into something and honestly say, I don't have a criminal investigation, but I got a call about something. It's irresponsible to just ignore it. But you maybe make a phone call or maybe go to one of the databases and say, is there, well, wait, this person, you know, maybe you know them, they're whatever, and say, yeah, there's nothing to it. Or you run a check and you find out, wait, they've been, that's a registered sex offender, they've been convicted of this and this. Now suddenly that little bit of information looks a little different to me.
We have two other items on our agenda. We want to get an update from the superintendent on the gang point of file audit that was done. And then we're going to have a presentation from Professor Nakima Levy-Pounds and the group at the University of St. Thomas, who have been convening a community process to give us some feedback on the gang databases. So, and we're running low on time, but I'm asking for your indulgence, given that we were late. And I'd like to get through these two points, and then we can come back for additional discussions. Superintendent.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The one last point I would make is that, Madam Chair, you've been to the MNJAC and have toured it, and Senator Higgins did very recently, and that is an open invitation to any members of the committee who would like to see and practice how this works. The gang pointer file, and I'll be very brief because Professor Levy-Pounds has worked on this and has studied it, and I don't want to duplicate what she's going to say, so I won't go through all the criteria. I will tell you very briefly about the audit that was conducted in the last few months or in the fall. Under 299C.091, that creates the gang pointer system and says that if an individual meets three of the 10 criteria, and if there is a conviction, a qualifying conviction, a gross misdemeanor or a felony, that name goes into the database. There were about 2,500 names in the database in the gang pointer system. Now, I'm not talking about GangNet, the gang pointer system. There were 2,500 names. 257 of those files were audited. As a result of that audit, it was found that 14 did not meet the criteria in a technical sense, if you will. For example, 8 of those 14, we went back to the local law enforcement agency who said, here's how we met that criteria, and determined that they did not have the documentation, or at least not filed correctly. They couldn't find the police report at the end of the day. And we had talked to the officer, or we had talked to people who said, no, this event occurred. I had that photo. I remember all this. But if you don't have the documentation still, either it's because you purged it yourself or because it was misfiled, I'm sorry, those files are getting deleted. So those were purged, that kind of a thing. What we're doing next is we have continued now to any information, anybody entered into the gang pointer system, if there is not a qualifying conviction within the three-year period after they were entered, they get purged. So we have gone through that process for now the most recent 3 months, November, December, and January are completed. And there were, in those 3 months, 153 names that came up to the three-year automatic purge. Of those, 80 or 52% were removed because there was not a qualifying event within that 3 years, and 73 had had a conviction within that three-year period, and those remained in the gang pointer system. So I can tell you with certainty that the file is, the gang pointer system is up to date in terms of the three-year purge limitations, and we have a system in place at the BCA now to continue doing that.
Superintendent, do you recall what the original rationale was for having juveniles be included in the pointer file system?
Not specifically, Madam Chair. I wasn't part of that discussion back in those days. I do know they cut the age at 14 and said 14 and over, and I suspect that some of the concern was that 15, 16, 17-year-olds were involved in activity that warranted having them identifiable. But I don't recall the exact discussion. I wasn't part of that.
It's just that we are very intentional about treating juveniles and adults differently, and I find that in this particular database, our pointer file system, that we very affirmatively allow ourselves to pool them into one data, into one pointer file database system, and that's concerning.
No, Madam Chair, the one thought that does come to me, and as we've looked at this much more closely over the last few years, and I mentioned earlier how criminal activity continues to change. And you go back to when this was first created, and there were gangs, and there were actions in the metropolitan area that was gang on gang very clearly. In the last few years, we don't see quite as much of that. Like I said, it's driven by criminal activity rather than you're wearing the wrong color and you're wearing the different. The allegiance, it's still there in some regards, but the allegiance isn't as strong as it used to be. And I can recall back in those days, there were very young gang members who were dying, who were involved in violent acts on both sides of it, either pulling the trigger or getting shot. And I think there was a movement that we really need to know who these people are so that when something happens, when a blood gets shot and we need to find where the Crips are, quickly, because almost all the time, that's what it was. I don't care their age. We need to find these people before there's a retaliatory shooting or whatever else might come next.
So given cybers, do we still need the gang pointer file system? If it's more criminal-oriented versus it being, you know, the gang piece of it not being important?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I think that's a very, very timely question. I don't think it's a yes or no answer. I think there are a lot of factors that go into that. I think there is a need, for example, for MNJAC's role to be based on active criminal investigations, to share that information. I don't care if they're in a gang or not. I don't care what it is. To be able to share that timely to solve crimes is critical. I do think it is timely, and I've talked to the professors coming next about it, to look at the 10-point criteria, to look at the efficacy of this system, to determine what standards should really be in place now. Criminal times have changed, and I think there are a lot of people that have input on that, and I'm not in a position to answer that just a simple yes or no.
Very good. Senator Limmer?
Madam Chair, to your question, I think in about 92 or 94, that was kind of the peak of street gang activity being developed in the metropolitan area of our state. And I think at that time, Minneapolis was experiencing record murder rates at that time, and there was a move by the legislature to recognize, they recognized that many of these crimes were being committed by kids that were 14 to 16 years old. And so the classification of certain crimes, personal assaults, for reporting and keeping a file was reduced, I think, from 16 to 14, because there was a definite trend. And Superintendent O'Malley is correct of why we got to that point. That's the history of it. I don't think it's been changed from a legislative prerogative since that time. And the numbers are probably relatively small right now when it comes to that age group. But nevertheless, it seems like the young people that were involved in those crimes had an association with a larger group, and it wasn't just a single act of violence from an individual person. It was more a motivation by a organization or a crime or a gang type initiation rights or a warring gang type interaction. And that's why we have the registration of those individuals more as an adult.
Thank you for that. It's good to have people who've been here a while to give us some historical knowledge.
Just talk to Betzold.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Superintendent. Just as a different geographic perspective, and I hope you'll let me know if I'm not correct about this, because in the wake of what happened with the Metro Gang Strike Force, we got all these reports from different gang task forces or strike forces around the state, and I look specifically at the gang-related activity that was reported up in my neck of the woods up in northern Minnesota, and my recollection was that up in that area that there has been an increase of gang-related activity and crime. And one of the concerns that has been raised to me kind of again and again, both from within tribal communities and law enforcement outside of tribal communities, is what we might do better from a government-to-government standpoint in terms of working together to address those issues. And some of those concerns have to do with data collection and sharing of data. Others just have to do with plain old agreements in terms of how to address these issues and make sure that tribal boundaries aren't being used as or the kind of a lack of agreements between law enforcement for how to deal with things that happen within tribal boundaries aren't being used as a way to, you know, provide kind of a safe haven for gang activity. And so I'm just wondering if, was that a correct reading of those reports, what I've said in terms of an increase up in northern Minnesota? And if so, how does that figure into what you're talking about?
Superintendent?
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, I think that is a correct statement that you made. I think there has been an increase, or at least not a decrease in the amount of gang criminal activity, in particular, as you mentioned, the Native American community between some of the reservations in northern Minnesota and into the Twin Cities. Over the past 2 years, we've had meetings with the Wisconsin Department of Criminal Investigation, the BCA, and all of the tribes in both Minnesota and Wisconsin about this exact topic, about how we can share information so that we can deal with some of the violent crime and the drugs and the gang activity on the reservations and off the reservations. What I don't know that I would come to the conclusion that you came to, that therefore this database is as essential. I think that it's still accurate to say while they're gang members, there's a way to deal with that, and maybe it's the database identifying them as gang members, but just as importantly, is there a way to share that information so that regardless of whether they're gang members or not, that we can have that information and connect those dots?
Senator Olson?
Madam Chair, Superintendent, just to make sure that I'm clarifying for you and anyone else, I'm not coming to that conclusion. You know, that I guess I was just asking for your reflection of whether that has any impact on your opinion or should have an impact on our opinion as we look at the storage of information, because I guess my concern is just what does need to be done, and maybe that's a broader discussion outside this meeting. If gang activity is decreasing elsewhere in the state but not in the area where I live, or if it's on the increase, what is the problem? Is it sharing of information, or is it something else, and what could we be doing about it?
Superintendent.
Madam Chair, if I could just comment real briefly. I know we're under time constraint. I don't intend to say that gang activity or gang criminal activity is decreasing. What I'm saying is that the type of criminal activity they're involved in doesn't often have to do with the fact that their allegiance is to a single gang, that we have seen partnerships develop among gang members that you would have thought would have shot each other 15 years ago. But now they're all interested in chasing the money, and there's all kinds of ways to do that, and the criminal activity is underlying. Not the gangs aren't still a huge issue. They are. And they form coalitions, and they're organized and that kind of thing. But it is broader than that, and it's a different type of allegiance than it used to be. I don't know if I'm explaining that well, but
thank you, Superintendent. Thank you, Mr. Johnson. I think it's been really informative today, and I appreciate you making the time. to come and share the information with us.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Professor Nakima Levy Pounds. Professor, thank you to you and your students who work really hard to put together a community process, and thank you for putting the report together, and we welcome you to the committee to share
thank
your
you.
Report with us.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Nakima Levy Pounds. I'm a law professor at the University of St. Thomas School of Law, as well as the director of the Community Justice Project. And with me is Matthew Stewart, who is a third-year law student at the University of St. Thomas. You all have raised a number of pertinent questions surrounding data privacy and gang databases, and that's obviously what brings us here today. We were contacted last summer by the St. Paul NAACP about concerns being raised by members of the community about the overrepresentation of African Americans in particular in the gang databases in Minnesota. And so the first step was to hold a town hall forum where we invited members from local law enforcement, at least one member of the judiciary was present, at least one county attorney was present, to get a sense of how gang databases are being used in Minnesota. And one of the disturbing things that happened as a result of that particular meeting was that we actually left with more questions than answers. Many of the members of that panel used the gang pornophile system and GangNet interchangeably, even though they are two very different databases. And so that was disconcerting for us, and we decided at that point to conduct our own independent review of those two gang databases. Now, there are other gang databases being used throughout the state of Minnesota, but the gang pornophile and GangNet are the two that we chose to focus on because they seem to be used more often than some of the other gang databases. And so with that, I'm going to have Matthew briefly run through the PowerPoint, which is in your folder, so that you can get more of an understanding of the two databases in question. And hopefully we'll be able to shed more light on this issue because there are some things that we need to be concerned about as a state in terms of the direction that we're going in regarding data privacy. And based on our findings and recommendations, I would urge that we proceed and tread with caution because we cannot allow anecdotes to dictate policy. We have to really take our time, think through the reasons why there is a need for data collection and classification of data. Also, what are the collateral consequences? And in the case of these gang databases, one of the things that we found is that it's really unclear what level of consequences exist. Now, we have some ideas of the types of collateral consequences that affect people who are inadvertently entered into gang databases or misidentified as gang members. But again, the full scope of the collateral consequences is really unclear. And that's a cause for concern that the community has. So with that, I'll ask Matt to quickly run through the PowerPoint so that you'll get more of an overview of the two databases in question.
Mr. Stewart, welcome to the committee. Please restate your name for the record.
Madam Chair, members, I'm Matthew Stewart. I'm with the Community Justice Project at St. Thomas School of Law. I'm going to just give you a brief overview of the Minnesota Gang Pointer File and also the GangNet, which were the two database systems that we looked at in our report. First, the Minnesota Gang Pointer File. This was created through Minnesota Statute 299C.091. And this statute gave the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension the authority to administer and maintain a computerized criminal gang database for the purpose of assisting criminal justice agencies in the investigation and prosecution of criminal activity by gang members. This section also laid out how one gets on the list, how one gets off the list, the auditing procedures, the classification of the information on the list as confidential, and also establish who's bound by the procedures laid out in this section. Specifically, the section states, the data in the file must be submitted and maintained as provided by the section. This means that every law enforcement agency that maintains the gang pointer file or enters information is bound to follow the requirements enumerated by the statute. The other statute to keep in mind when we consider the gang pointer file is Minnesota statute 299A.641. Through this statute, the Gang and Drug Oversight Council was created, and one of the main duties of this council was to come up with the 10-point criteria which is used for entering data into the system. So how does a person get into the gang pointer system? A person is entered into the gang pointer file if they're at least 14 years or older, convicted of a gross misdemeanor or felony, and meet three of the 10-point criteria that I just spoke of. In the interest of time, I'm not going to go through and read every single one of the 10-point criteria, but you should have a copy in your folder that we handed out. So who is in the gang pointer file? At the time of our report, we found there was 2,438 alleged gang members in the system. Broken down by racial and ethnic groups, we found a definite overrepresentation of communities of color. Specifically, 1,324 entries were African American. This makes up 54% of all the entries in the file, where African Americans make up 4.6% of the Minnesota population. If you're following along on the PowerPoint slides, you'll notice that Hispanic and Latino individuals are not on the list. They were included with the white statistics in there. Now, once a person is on the gang pointer file, how do they get out? Well, you're removed from the gang pointer file if 3 years have elapsed and you've not been convicted of any crime or met any new criteria. There's also a provision where a law enforcement officer can remove you if there was a mistake in entering some data. And because the information in the gang pointer file is confidential, an individual is only made aware of their presence on a confidential list. They do not know which particular database they're part of or what information is being stored on them.
And they're not made aware they have their request.
Well, they aren't automatically. And, yeah, it goes without saying they're not made aware that they have to request in the first place what the procedures are for obtaining that information. The second system that we looked at was the GangNet database system. This was developed and maintained through funding from the Minnesota Department of Public Safety. It was approved by the Ramsey County Board. This system is maintained by the Ramsey County Sheriff's Office, and we are aware that 96 law enforcement agencies use this database. This was originally developed as a feeder system to the gang pointer file, but is later developed into a multi-purpose information share for many different agencies. Now, how does a person get into GangNet? They only have to meet one of the 10-point criteria. There's no age requirement, and there is no need to have been convicted of a crime. At the time we performed our report and research, there were 16,764 suspected gang members in GangNet. Once again, there was an overrepresentation of communities of color, with 7,108 African Americans in the system, representing 42.4% of all the entries. Once again, African Americans make up 4.6% of the Minnesota population by and large. As far as getting out of the GangNet system, at the time of our report, you were removed from GangNet after 10 years if you had not met any of the new criteria and had not been convicted of a crime. Since our report has come out, we understand that Ramsey County has changed this 10-year period down to 5 years and also have added a parental notification where if a minor is in the system, the parent or guardian is told. Since these changes, we understand that close to 6,000 names have been purged from the GangNet system. Finally, the last slide I'm going to go through is just a side-by-side comparison of the pointer file and GangNet. Just broadly, as you can see, communities of color are overrepresented in both databases. African Americans make up a substantial percentage of all the entries in the GangNet and gang pointer file systems. The threshold for entry into GangNet is much lower than the gang pointer file. You only need to meet one of the 10-point criteria. And you remain in the GangNet file much longer than with the gang pointer file. In GangNet, you are in the system for 5 years, whereas with the gang pointer file, you're removed after 3 years. With that, I'll turn it back to Professor Levy-Pounds to voice some of the community concerns with these two systems and also our recommendations for change.
Thank you, Matt.
Professor?
Thank you, Madam Chair. As Matt just stated, there were a number of community concerns surrounding the use of the gang databases in the Twin Cities. On page 3 of your PowerPoint, we list a number of those community concerns, such as the use of the 10-point criteria and whether or not it's too subjective and repetitive. You have a sheet in your folder that lists those criteria. You can take a look for yourself. And a huge part of the concern regarding the 10-point criteria is whether or not, for example, a young African-American male who lives in an inner-city community can end up in GangNet simply by living in the community or having a relative who might be a gang member or people in the neighborhood, people that they've gone to school with, because you only need to meet one of the 10 criteria. And so our concern is that this has led to a huge swelling in the gang net system, specifically for communities of color. It's unclear whether or not these are effective tools for law enforcement. We were actually attended a meeting just last week with law enforcement, high-ranking law enforcement officials from the Minneapolis Police Department and the St. Paul Police Department, and both groups indicated that these tools are ineffective. And that was surprising to us that they made those particular statements. So it really is a question of whether or not these are effective tools. One of the things that we are pushing for on behalf of the community is a balance. You know, obviously the community wants to feel safe. No one wants gang activity in their neighborhood. No one wants gang violence in their neighborhood. But at the same time, people do not want to be subjected to unwarranted governmental intrusion or stereotyped by virtue of their race and their class. And that seems to be one of the things that could be happening here. As you indicated, sir, Senator Limmer, in the 90s, there was, you know, Minneapolis was dubbed Murderapolis, and seemingly for good reason. But it seems that times have changed, and because of the change, we're advocating for a change in the 10-point criteria, really to assess the 10-point criteria and ensure that it's still relevant with regard to what types of gang activity are actually occurring today. And we've heard many in law enforcement say that is a relevant point of consideration, whether or not we need to reevaluate the 10-point criteria. The community also had concerns about racial profiling, a lack of adult notification, a lack of parental notification. I noticed earlier that questions came up regarding youths being entered into the system. And one of the issues that the community has regarding this issue is the fact that there's all this data that's being collected on 14-year-olds, 15-year-olds, 16-year-olds, but what is being done with it? We know from the research that suppression tactics alone are not effective, and you also need intervention and prevention. And so that's one of the things that the community is asking for, that there be resources devoted towards intervention and prevention and not just suppression, especially if there are youths who are suspected gang members or who are actively involved in gangs. The hope is that there is some intervention that takes place so that they can be on the path to college or being a law-abiding citizen, if that really is the case. And so with the data being collected, there needs to be a use for the data that is really going to contribute to a healthier Minnesota overall. Other concerns include difficulty of verifying whether one's data is actually included in a gang database. Matthew intimated that people are not necessarily notified that they're in a database. There's nothing saying that they have to be specifically notified, but one of the concerns by community members is that people are being unjustly placed in databases, people who are either not in gangs at all or who were involved in gangs as teenagers but who left the gangs and became law-abiding citizens. They're concerned that their names being placed in a gang database leads to a negative impact on employment, college opportunities, et cetera. And again, because this issue has not been studied in depth, it's unclear what the full range of collateral consequences are to people who are in this system. As Matthew stated, Ramsey County Sheriff's Office has added parental notification. We did ask that that actually become retroactive. It's our understanding, though, that they're saying going forward there will be parental notification. It's unclear with regard to both databases how many youths are in these systems. And again, what's being done with the data that would actually lead to something more productive for Minnesota. There's a concern for trustworthiness of data entered by Metro by the Metro Gang Strike Force. As you all know from reading Andy Luger's report, there are a number of issues concerning the credibility of data. In fact, in Andy Luger's report, there is a statement regarding the fact that they found photographs of children who were not actually involved in gang membership. When we went out into the community, that was one of the concerns that we heard from community members, that members of law enforcement would round up young African-American boys and have them pose for photographs together and then document them as gang members. And what happened to those photographs, you know, are unclear from Mr. Luger's report, but that is something that I think is a question that should be asked, because I don't think any of us would want our children misdocumented as gang members, again, based on reasons that are inconsistent with their actual status in a gang. And I mentioned before about the collateral consequences piece and how we have to be careful and make sure that the data that are being entered into these systems are accurate. We know that in 2007, the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension conducted an audit of the gang pornophile, and out of that audit, there was a 15% rate of inaccuracy. Now, in the most recent audit, as Superintendent O'Malley stated, there was a 5% rate of inaccuracy. We're unclear of what happened between 2007 and 2009 that caused for a 10% decrease in the rate of inaccuracy, but again, that goes to the community's concerns regarding ensuring that everyone's name who is in the database actually belongs there, assuming that we will continue to have gang databases. And so we've included a number of different recommendations that we have talked to different people in law enforcement about, including Sheriff Fletcher, which is part of what led to the changes that he's made to the GangNet system. But as you can see on page 5 of your PowerPoint, we're asking the question of whether GangNet should remain in existence. We believe that according to the research that we have done, coupled with the community's concerns, that that is still a fair question. It's our understanding that GangNet, as Matthew stated, was originally set out to be a repository of people who had started to meet the criteria that's set forth for inclusion in the gang pornophile. But it does not seem that the original intention was to have a database that contained nearly 17,000 names. So there is the need to determine whether or not GangNet is an effective tool for law enforcement. And so our hope is that from the community's perspective, we would move more towards evidence-based practices, ensuring that there is accountability, accuracy, transparency, fairness, and effectiveness within the system. On page 4, we list a number of those recommendations that we've made regarding reevaluating the 10-point criteria, timely notification and a hearing opportunity, ensuring that there's community engagement throughout the process. We have community members who are very active, specifically within St. Paul, and who want to have some input into these processes, especially because of the impact on children and on communities. Implementing prevention and intervention models, making sure that there's an effective use of the data. Oversight and accountability, figuring out who actually has the authority to input data into the system. Are there proper checks and balances in place? Does an officer need supervisory approval to be able to enter data, or is it just based on that person's statement that they feel that someone is a gang member? We think that there needs to be an improvement of audit and purge requirements. In the original statute that authorized the gang pornophile, it says that the BCA must conduct periodic and random audits of the gang pornophile, but there's no specificity regarding how often these audits need to take place, and the information is not made public. And so one thing that we're recommending is that there maybe be a set schedule of when audits will take place to ensure that all of the files within a reasonable period of time have been examined. Right now, given the lack of potential reliability of the files that were entered by the Metro Gang Strike Force, there is a need to make sure that all of these files have been reviewed. From our estimation, upwards of 90% of the data could have been entered by the Metro Gang Strike Force. So again, this is a question that needs to be examined. So with that, I will open it up if there are any questions.
Any questions? Senator Limmer?
Thank you. Professor, I came in a little late when you were starting, but you had made reference that the community is concerned. Could you tell me what community we're talking about?
Yes. I am speaking primarily about the African-American community. We actually held a series of four town hall meetings beginning last summer and up until December, where we discussed a number of these issues related to the gang databases. Those town hall meetings were very well attended. Again, it was mostly African-American adults and children who were present, but there were also members from across the metro area. We had people come over from Minneapolis, and there were people from different racial and ethnic groups who were present as well. But the St. Paul NAACP was the group that originally started to receive complaints from members of the African-American community, which then led to our independent report.
Madam Chair, Professor, it'd be helpful if you have future meetings, I'd love to be invited to them and just sit in the room and take notes.
Wonderful. We would welcome.
I think
your
I attendee. Probably would speak on behalf of everyone here if they had time. The other question I had is you made mention that potential employers or colleges may have knowledge of someone on this list. How would they get information on a list that may be considered private?
Well,
Professor?
Actually, the information is confidential, which has its own set of issues because, again, the person is not made aware
right.
that their information is the scope of the information that is being held by the BCA or by the sheriff's office. With regard to employers, we heard anecdotes from at least two people who suggested that they were denied a permit to carry a weapon for the sake of employment. For example, one person wanted to apply for a position with the National Guard, but he was denied a permit to carry. The other person was studying criminal justice at a local college, and he was also denied a permit to carry. And so from the people that we've spoken to, from their perspective, they're first of all declaring that they are not involved in gangs. One person said he's never been involved in a gang. The other person said that in his youth he was involved in a gang, but is not, is a law-abiding citizen, is employed, is taking care of his son. But this database label follows him from his perspective. Our hope is that colleges don't have access to the list. We don't know, for example, also whether the Minnesota Department of Human Services somehow in conducting a background check would get any information pertaining to who was in a database. So it's just really unclear at this point regarding what full impact this has on a person's life. In terms of applying for college, someone who knows that they are on a list may feel deterred from applying to college if, for example, they assume that a background check or a college asking them a question might have an impact. But we haven't heard of specific people who've been denied access to college as a result of being in the database.
Madam Chair,
Senator
I think those who apply for military service have to sign a waiver for either the federal government or the National Guard to examine their criminal record. They don't It's not like it used to be in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s where anyone would be taken and if you had a heartbeat, you could go into military service. It's much more selective than that now. But nevertheless, the individual signs a waiver for an examination of public records to determine whether or not they have that type of background. But I was very interested in whether or not colleges could determine that. But right now, you don't. You're just fearful of the idea that they might deter someone who may not necessarily have a criminal behavior, but they're put on a file and then it got folded in as something much more than that.
Okay. Well, and then if I may quickly,
Professor.
Well, there is another issue too that is related, which is according to the research that we've conducted, a person who is listed in a gang database is more likely to have contacts with law enforcement. And what impact will that have? Will they be arrested, you know, for minor offense because they are a perceived gang member? That's another question that could impact. And so if a person is arrested and they have to put on a college application or a job application that they were arrested, even if the case is dismissed, what impact is that going to have on the person? Because of the perception that they are involved in a gang, especially if they are not actually involved in a gang.
Yeah, Madam Chair, one
Senator
last
Lamar.
Question. I don't know if colleges ask questions of whether you're arrested. I think they may have, I don't even know if they ask a question if you've been convicted of a crime. I'm not familiar with college applications, but.
You soon will be.
We're already there. But I'm just wondering if we even ask that question. You know?
We'll find out. We'll find out.
I know for law school.
We'll find out.
For sure.
Yeah. Senator Olson. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I was going to ask sort of a related question to what Senator Limmer asked, but I'll just kind of try to follow up on that a little bit more and then also say that I would hope that none of us have to leave here still wondering about the answer to what you said it was hard to determine, because I would think we have people here who could answer these questions, which are very legitimate concerns. The difference, in my opinion, between what Senator Limmer talked about with people having signing a waiver, to me that's not really the issue, because the criteria here, and I understand the need to have to be able to, for law enforcement to be able to identify and deal with gang-related criminal behavior. But this is a real broad list. And there are a lot of things on this list that aren't crimes. And so, you know, when you have a very broad kind of subjective and a list of things that are do not constitute crimes, and then you're precluded by, you know, from an employment opportunity because someone doing a background check finds your name on a list of something that kind of looks like you're a criminal, but you haven't actually even been arrested for anything having to do with criminal activity. I think that's the concern. It's not that you sign the waiver. It's that should you be identified as a criminal if you're not, in fact, a criminal. And so so I wonder if we could get some response maybe from the superintendent or Mr. Johnson or someone who could clarify for us a little bit the extent to which this information would be available to a third party outside of, you know, gang task force type criminal activity. So is this, if someone's doing a criminal background check, do they get this information? Like people who are looking at for housing, you know, running standard criminal background checks, or who doesn't have access to this information, I guess is my question.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Johnson, could you talk a little bit about, or maybe Superintendent, I'm sorry, whichever one will have the information about GangNet, about the gang pointer file. With respect to GangNet members, the committee did extend an invitation to Sheriff Fletcher to come talk to us about the GangNet system. He had a previous engagement and couldn't come. We asked for him to send somebody who knows something about GangNet to come so that we can ask some questions, and they declined to send somebody on behalf of the sheriff's office to talk with us about GangNet. So if there's an interest on the part of the members, we'll certainly follow up with an extended another invitation for the sheriff's office to come and talk to us. Mr. Johnson?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, the gang pointer file is classified as confidential data. And therefore, as such, an individual who is in that system cannot give their informed consent to allow access to that data, and it cannot be used for colleges or any of these other points of reference that Professor Levy Pounds has talked about, because it is classified as confidential. So therefore, it's not usable.
Mr. Johnson, what about Department of Human Services background checks for some of the statutorily required jobs where we have to do statutory background checks?
Madam Chair and members, that's a great question, and unfortunately, I don't know the answer to that other than to tell you that the Department of Human Services does have access to certain criminal history information and other information, predatory offender information and so forth, in order for them to make decisions. All of those access points are ones that have been approved by the legislature and embodied in statute. And I'm sorry, I don't know the answer specifically in regard to running a check to see if someone's in a gang pointer file.
Ms. Pontius?
Oh, Madam Chairman, I just say, the DHS background check statutes specifically focus on convictions. So they do get access to conviction data. For example, they can get access to data that's gone through expungement. They can get access to data on juveniles, so they could get that. I don't think that they would be able to get access to the gang net or the gang pointer file data, but they could get the underlying convictions. That was part of why somebody might have been entered into the pointer file.
Madam Chair?
Senator Higgins?
Ms. Pontius, did you say they could get access to expunged data?
Ms. Pontius?
Yes, I believe they can get, even though data is expunged, that they can still get it, unless the expungement order specifically is directed to the Commissioner of Human Services. So the court, it kind of depends on how the order is framed.
Ms. Pontius, is this one of those areas where we go into the convoluted conversation about executive branch expungement and judicial branch expungements and what gets sort of expunged and what doesn't? Is this one of those things?
Madam Chair, yeah, it starts to go down that road. But
I see.
Madam Chair?
Yeah. Professor?
One last thing. If someone is applying for a law enforcement position, that's another question that we have of whether or not their status in GangNet or gang pornify will have an impact on whether they are considered to be qualified for a law enforcement position.
I see Mr. Jordal taking notes, so we'll get the information and we'll make that available. Any other members? We are now past 6 o'clock, and I know that our staff have been here all day. The members of the public have been here all day. We will definitely have an opportunity to revisit this issue as we move forward. This is why I felt it was important for us to have a hearing and to just sort of have an opportunity to talk about the big picture, but also have a couple of real issues as examples for us to think about in terms of the significance of databases. And I just think that both from Superintendent O'Malley's testimony and Mr. Johnson's testimony, and now the professor's information, I think that law enforcement has a real need to be able to track the criminal signatures and the modes of operations. But I also feel like there is also a need on our part to make sure that we're profiling the criminal activities and not necessarily profiling individuals. And I think that that's the balance that we as that's our charge, I think, on this committee, is how do we help law enforcement with some critical tools in today's reality, in today's world, are critical for a law enforcement perspective. But how do we gain some lessons learned from these experiences, and how do we work with our professionals who are working at this to say, moving forward, how do we profile the criminal activities and the signatures of those criminal activities and not profile individuals in terms of labeling them, whether that's as gang members or et cetera. We, in essence, are profiling individuals. And so I look forward to the committee using this event as sort of a foundation as we move forward to a further discussion about databases and a discussion about some of the things that the department and the agency is interested in having us look at, but also want to be responsive to the community on your concerns on the profiling piece of it. And lastly, members, I just want you I want to share this with you that the superintendent put together a really great one-day seminar for all of us on criminal intelligence gathering and sharing of data. And I found his presenter, Mr. Russ Porter, to have a really thoughtful points about how we maybe can put some parameters around databases. Because at the end of the day, it's not that we're anti being smart about finding crime, but we just have concerns about the amount of discretions that gets exercised. And Mr. Porter said that as we think about how to enact policies, we should really pay attention to how we can eliminate unnecessary discretion, structure the remaining discretion, and then provide oversight to make sure that what is happening is in line with what we wish as policymakers. And I think that those were very, very thoughtful points for us to keep at the back of our minds as we move forward. So I want to thank you for making the time to be here so late in the day, but I think it's been really, really critical for us to have this conversation. I want to thank members of the public, and in particular the superintendent and Mr. Johnson and the professor for being here. And to our staff, thank you so much. We are adjourned.
Thank you. Thank you.